I'm waiting for the fact that when you come to leave, you want to come.
After the very difficult parsha of Eishes Shifas Tohar, the Torah goes on and introduces the idea that when you have a firstborn son, the firstborn son gets what is called a pishnayim, gets what is called a double portion of the inheritance. That basically means he is treated like an extra son. So if I have two sons and one of them is a bechor, so the Bechor gets two-thirds of the inheritance, and the non-Bechor gets one-third of the inheritance. Right? This is the din of a Bechor. And there are many halachas about Bechor. There's a whole parak in Maseches Bava Basra dealing with the rights of a firstborn. For example, one halacha that Rashi brings is a Bechor gets a double portion only in property that was in the possession of the father at the time of the father's death. But property that the father does not acquire a right to until after the father's death is divided equally. So let me give you an example. Let's imagine you have a grandfather, and the grandfather has an only son. I'll keep it as simple as possible. But grandfather, only son, an only son has two boys, a bechor and a non-bechor. Father dies before his father. Father dies before grandfather. So the bechor gets a double portion, and the non-bechor gets only a single portion. After father dies, grandfather dies. Now the way this works is, grandfather's estate goes to the father in the grave, and from the father it goes to the sons. But when the sons divide grandfather's estate, they divide grandfather's estate equally. Because grandfather's assets were not part of the father's estate at the time the father died. The Gezeiras HaKasav is, a Bechor gets a double portion only in what the father owned at the time of the death, and not in an inheritance that passes through the father after the father dies. Now, there is a whole machlokas in the Gemara. How do you characterize collection of debt? Let's say money was owed to the father, but the money was not collected until after the father's death. Do the children divide equally, or does the bechor get pishnayim? Some opinions say that since the money was owed to the father at the time of his death, that will be sufficient. Others' opinions say that the father didn't have the money till he died, and therefore it'll be divided equally. Now, the phrase that is used to describe this is a bechor is notel pishnayim. A bechor gets a double portion only in muchzak. Muchzak is the magic word. Muchzak is assets in possession of the father at the time of his death, and not beraoi, and not in raoi, something that is fitting to come to the father later. And that is actually derived from the wording of the pasuk itself. Right? The pasuk says, if you have a chumash and you look at Perek Chaf Aleph, chapter 21, verse 17, Yudzayin, Es ben abuchor ben asnua yakir, you shall recognize the rights of the firstborn, even if it comes from a hated wife. Lasei slo pishnayim, to give him a double portion. B'chayel asher yimatzei lo, everything that is found in the father's house. So that's a superfluous phrase, and that picks up the idea. It has to be found in the father's rishus, and not something that the father gets later. Ki hu reishis, oh no, because he is the first of his strength. Now, there are a few questions I just want to raise. First of all, keep in mind that there are therefore two different halachos that pertain to firstborn boys. One halacha is pidyon haben, which is not in this parsha. And that is, if you are a firstborn son, and by that I mean, it's always ambiguous. Being the firstborn son is not going to help you if there's a girl born before you. You have to be the firstborn child who is a male. If you are the firstborn child who is a male, you must be redeemed by paying the kohen on the 31st day after your birth, or later if you haven't done it. If you haven't done it, please see a rabbi. We can arrange pidyon haben. We can even arrange circumcision, but hopefully that won't be necessary. But from day 31 onwards, a sum of money, 5 sala'im, which is kind of 5 silver dollars, are given to a kohen to redeem the firstborn, because every firstborn was miraculously saved by God in the plague of the firstborn. So God kind of owns them, and they have to be ransomed by giving money to the kohen. That's called pidyon haben. And the other is the din of inheritance that is called pi shnayim. But I hope you understand that the definition of what is a firstborn differs in the two cases. Pidyon haben depends on being the firstborn of the mother, not the father. So let's say dad was married before, and dad has kids, but he marries a woman who never had children before, and this child is the first child to emerge from the womb. That child gets a pidyon haben, even though it is not the first child of the father, it is the first child of the mother. So pidyon haben is toloi on what is called peter rechem, opening up the womb of the mother. Pishnayim is exactly the opposite. The double portion of inheritance is not based on the mother, it's based on the father. So let's take an opposite scenario. Dad never had kids before. He marries a woman that did have children before. The firstborn male child of the father will get a double portion of inheritance. Okay, so it's interesting that although both of these halachos apply to a bechor, the definition of what is a bechor will vary from pidyon haben and yerusha. So one of the questions I want to raise, again, it's not so much in the Chumash directly, but just to be aware of the halacha here, is the Torah has all sorts of inheritance rules that are a bit difficult for us. The Torah says if there's a son and a daughter, the son gets everything, the daughter gets nothing. Remember, that's the whole parsha of the daughters of Tzelafchad. When there are no sons, daughters inherit, but otherwise, sons get everything. That's one rule. Another rule is if there are multiple sons and one is a firstborn, he gets a double portion. The question is, halachically, are you allowed to change that by a will? If I'm a father, I have sons and daughters. I want my girls to get the same thing as the boys. Am I allowed, halachically, legally, of course I could do it, but the question is, does Jewish law allow me to write a will that says I want my sons and my daughters to be equal? Or the other way, or with sons, does Jewish law allow me to basically say, I want all of my sons to be equal. I don't want the Bechor to get double the other son. Meaning, to what degree can these laws of inheritance be modified or changed by what is called a tzava'a, which is a will. Okay, now before I answer that question, I want to go back just to be sure that you don't misunderstand something. I had said, which seems to be the halacha, that when you have sons and daughters, under the laws of inheritance, the sons get everything and the daughters get nothing. I want to modify that. It is not as bleak as you might assume. Even though it is true that the sons get all of the ownership of the property, that is true, but the daughters are entitled to be supported the same way they were supported when their father was alive until they get married. And when they get married, they're entitled to 10% of the estate as a dowry. Now, that's an interesting question. So what if you have 10 daughters? Each one gets 10% when they get married. So it's a complicated formula. It's actually 10% on a declining balance. Anyone here have an accounting background? Okay, this is an accounting formula, so I don't know if you were exposed to this. The way it works is the following. Let's say dad dies, and dad has an estate, I'll use a bigger number, $1 million. When the oldest daughter is ready to get married, she gets $100,000 as a dowry. Now that leaves a $900,000 in the estate. When second daughter gets married, she doesn't get 10% of the original million, she gets 10% of the 900,000. That's called a declining balance. Now that does mean that last daughter gets the smallest dowry. But after all the daughters are married, we take the total amount of dowry that was distributed and we then divide it equally. So that means the first one that got the 100,000 is going to have to keep some money in reserve because it's going to have to be shared. But that ensures that the estate never goes down to zero, because it's always 10% on a declining balance. The point of this example is just to illustrate that even when you worked under the regimen that sons got everything, it really didn't mean that the daughters were left out in the dark, in the cold, but rather they did have dowry rights and they had support rights and the like. Okay. By the way, the same is true for a widow. Technically, unlike secular law, when a man dies, his property goes to his children, not to his wife. His wife does not inherit. When a wife dies, the property goes to her husband. When a husband dies, it does not go to the wife, it goes to the kids. So where does that leave the widow? So the widow is entitled to live in the family house and be supported, etc. So even though the sons own everything, they have to support their mother the same way, that the father supported her until she gets married to somebody else. Okay, but to go back to the first question, okay, this is the halacha, but does the halacha allow me to write a will to make the bechor equal to the non-bechor? Does halacha allow me to make the sons and the daughters equal? So this is a big, big machlokas. This is a machlokas among contemporary poskim. The great posek, Rav Moshe Feinstein, I hope you've heard of Rav Moshe Feinstein, he died in around, I think, 1986, but he was a tremendous, tremendous gadol in Psak Halacha. In fact, if you permit me to digress, I will tell you a personal story I have with Rav Moshe Feinstein. When I was, I grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, if you know New England, and Rav Moshe Feinstein, when I was a child, he used to come for his summer vacation. He would come for 2 weeks a year to Hartford, Connecticut, because he had a relative there. And our joke used to be he wanted to go to a place where nobody would be asking him shilas. So Hartford was a safe place. They didn't bother him too much with all of the difficult shilas. But I remember I was in fourth grade. This is not 1986. This goes back to the 60s. I was in fourth grade, and I used to go to shul on my way to yeshiva. I would go to shul, so I would daven in a shul, and I would be in the car that would take Rabbi Feinstein to shul. So I remember, I never spoke to him, but I remember sitting next to him and looking at him, and you know, and I distinctly remember a radiance on his face, a shine. I remember it as a kid. Yeah, there's something special about you. Very, very short. And all of the things I read about in books later, and in fact, when he used to wrap up his tefillin, he would be learning Mishnayos, you know, or during Kaddish, he figured out exactly, you know, certain part of Kaddish you have to stand, but the last line of Kaddish you can sit, you know. So he would like sit for the last line and open up a chumash, you know, like he didn't, you know, every second he would learn when you were allowed to learn. When you weren't allowed to learn, he didn't. So my story about Rav Feinstein was that one time davening was over, and I was still davening for some reason, and it was raining outside. And I had to walk around a block and a half to get to school. No big deal. And there's a knock at the shul door, and the guy who drove us to shul came back and he said, Rabbi Feinstein asked me to come back for you. He remembered you were in the car, and he didn't want you to walk to school in the rain. So he asked me to come back and pick you up. Now, nobody else cared, and I didn't care. It really made no difference for me to walk in the rain. It makes a difference even now for me to walk in the rain. It doesn't bother me. But here you have the Gadol Hador, the person who was like the greatest rabbi of the generation, in which every single complicated shaila of Am Yisrael, life and death matters, were all brought to him. It used to be said that on the back of every person's rabbinical ordination was the phone number, it's a joke, of Rav Moshe Feinstein, so in case you got stuck, you know, you'd have the great rabbi to call. So here is a person who was like totally involved in the entire problems of the whole world. And he remembered that a fourth grader, a nine-year-old, shouldn't have to walk in the rain. And I have to tell you what an impression that made upon me, because we could talk about Rav Moshe as a genius, and we could talk about him as knowing the whole Talmud by heart and learning the Shulchan Aruch 1,000 times, all of which is true, and his total mastery of Torah. But you see that what makes a person really great is not only how smart they are, and not only how brilliant they are, and not even only how much of a masma they are, although that is so important, but their midos and their caring and their love, and the fact that nobody is unimportant not to be worried about. Meaning there is nothing to, the saying goes, to a great person, there is no such thing as a small matter. A great person takes everybody with great kavod. So to this day, maybe it's a difficult standard. This is how I judge gedolim, because this is my very limited experience with a gadol, and to me, that is the definition of a gadol. And you know, if great Talmidei Chachamim don't live up to that, you know, then they're not up there on that level. They could be very, very great, but that's not the highest level of greatness. So Rav Moshe, and anyway, we're going back to the wills. Rav Moshe Feinstein does write in his Tshuvas, Igros Moshe, that halacha does legitimate a will. That's very, very interesting. Halacha does say you are allowed to write a will, and if you write a will, that will supersede the laws of inheritance. And his argument is based on an important halachic principle, that in monetary matters, only in monetary matters, we have a principle called dina de malchusa dina. Now, dina de malchusa dina means the civil secular law is binding upon Jews halakhically when it pertains to things like taxes, paying money, and the like. You're not allowed to evade taxes. So Rav Feinstein says, since under the secular law of the land, wills are valid, they will be valid halakhically as well. Now let me point out that if that is Rav Moshe's basis, that's going to be a very unusual consequence in Eretz Yisrael, because there are opinions, not all opinions, that say that the validity of secular law on Jews is only in Chutz La'aretz. Eretz Yisrael must follow the law of the Torah. So you'd have an interesting point, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, that it might be that a will be valid halachically only if I live in New York. But if I live here, I got to follow the laws of the Torah, based on the idea that Dina de Malchusa Dina does not work in Eretz Yisrael. Now, I do want to say that in spite of Rav Moshe's absolute greatness, most poskim do not agree with Rav Moshe. Most poskim say a will is not halachically valid. Now, let's step back and think what that means. A will is not halachically valid. Let's say I write a will that says, it is my desire that my son share equally with my daughter. Now, it's not halachically valid. Meaning to say, the son is still the yoresh. But, it is an expression of what I would like my son to do. So if my son voluntarily will share with his sister, that's perfectly fine. So in a sense, you have to be sure you understand this. Just because a will is invalid doesn't stop my son from voluntarily carrying out, and that would be a fulfillment of honoring father and mother. So here is my point. If you know your children, and your children don't fight, and they care about each other, and they're nice, presume to, hey, go ahead and write a will, because what we would normally expect is the son will carry it out. But here is the rub. If the son doesn't want to carry it out, and his sister takes him to court to carry out the will, according to Rav Moshe, she can do that, but according to most poskim, she is a thief. She is stealing what rightfully belongs to the son. So my point is, if the son is voluntarily going to do it, you don't even get into the debate. You can always write a will saying, this is my wish. But if push comes to shove, and the son refuses, and the daughter wants to force this issue, which unfortunately happens, according to Rav Moshe, she has that right. According to most poskim, she is not allowed to do it. It is gezel. She is stealing. And by the way, the same thing would be true for the Bechor and the non-Bechor. Same issue. If I say in my will, I would like my Bechor to share his double portion with his brothers, if the Bechor does it willingly, it's perfectly fine. And I'm certainly allowed to tell, like every opinion, I'm certainly allowed to tell my children, this is what I want you to do. But if push comes to shove, and the Bechor says no, according to most poskim, except for Rav Moshe Feinstein, the will is not valid, and the Bechor has to be done. So the way this is done practically, and I don't want to get into all the techniques, is that there are various halachic and legal mechanisms where the property is transferred before the father dies. See, before you die, you could certainly give whatever you want. So there are ways of doing it, not through a will. A will is not effective till death. And once there's death, the laws of inheritance kick in. But if you kind of arrange it even 1 second before death, so halacha would allow that, because you're just giving away your property when you're still alive. Now, you don't want to do it too early. You don't want to give away your property, you know, when you have 25 years left. Then you're not going to have anything. But halacha has different ways. So at some point, if any of you are writing wills, you know, I could talk to you about it. But this is called halachic estate planning. And there are actually religious lawyers who specialize in allowing the creation of these documents to allow children to be treated equally. The bottom line is, though, that philosophically you're allowed to do those things, meaning as long as you follow the halachic guidelines, you are permitted to distribute your property in different ways. Yeah?
So you said that we could write wills because they're accepted in, like, the secular court.
That's Rav Moshe Feinstein.
Rav Moshe, yeah. But you still can't go against halacha to write, yeah. Like, in general, you can't, if secular and halacha conflict, you can't just go against halacha. So
yes.
If you write a will where the firstborn doesn't get double share, isn't that going against the law?
So this is what Rav Moshe Feinstein's argument is. It's a little circular, but Rav Moshe Feinstein's argument is, it is true that when there is a contradiction between secular law and halacha, you have to follow halacha, 100%. But Dina de Malchusa Dina is in itself a halachic rule. And the halachic rule says that when it comes to, not everything, when it comes to property and money and financial assets, halacha itself says you can follow the secular law. So when you're following secular law, you're no longer contradicting halacha, you are following a halachic rule that permits you to disregard halacha, because that's dina de malchusa dina. In other words,
is it an exception for financial stuff?
Now the question is, what's the source of it? That's a good question. But it is an exception for financial rules. What is the source of it? There are various sources that are given. One is a verse in the Navi Jeremiah. in which when the Jews went into Galus, they were told to follow the laws of the land, and the like. Now, I do want to point out, though, once again, that I did say a majority of poskim disagree with Rav Moshe, and they say, hey, exactly your point. You cannot contradict halacha by making wills, and dina d'malchusadina just means you got to pay taxes and things like that. Well, you're not contradicting halacha. You're not allowed to contradict. So the emphasis is Rav Moshe's use of dina d'malchusadina is a problematical use. I will admit that to you, but that's what he wants to say. Yeah.
Is there a category of halacha that you're allowed to contradict according to secular law, if secular law applies?
Well, generally speaking, you know, we owe our obedience to God above man. So if there's a contradiction, we got to follow halacha. But as I say, when it comes to monetary matters. Only monetary. So if the government says, you know, you got to work on Shabbos, you know, you don't listen to them. But in monetary matters, this is called in Aramaic, dina de malchusa. That means the law of the land, the law of the government. Is binding. By the way, this is very important. This is why, you know, you're not allowed to cheat on your taxes. This is according to everybody. Because if the law of the land says you got to pay taxes, you have to pay your taxes. That's why if you have employees, you have to give them minimum wages. You have to obey environmental and health laws. It's not just a matter of secular law. Jewish law, halacha, says you got to obey those laws. But again, you're 100% correct. You're not contradicting the Torah there. See, Rav Moshe's problem is you're contradicting, and that's why it's much more problematical. But when there's no contradiction, even the speed limit, you got to obey speed limits. Now, it's an interesting question. What if the speed limit is 65, but everybody's going 75? Do I say that changes the law? Meaning, there's a law in the books, and there's the law as it's applied. But somebody told me that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky was another very, very great rabbi. You know, he was coming back from a wedding, 3 o'clock in the morning in Brooklyn, and for some reason the red lights were still going, meaning they didn't have flashing. And he made the driver stop at every red light. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. There were no cars. Like, you know, why not go through a red light? There are no cars for miles. Rav Yaakov said, the law of the land says you must stop at a red light. You must stop at a red light even if nobody is around. That was kind of an extreme example of obeying the laws of the land. Yeah?
If you break like a secular law like that,
yep.
Is it as if you obviously break the secular law, but is it also as if you break halakha?
That's exactly right. That's a very important point. The duty to obey secular law is a halakhic religious principle. So when you fail to obey that secular law, that's right, you are violating God's will. Not just, and that's why, even if you know you're not going to get caught, you know, you're violating Hashem knows. Now, this does give rise to interesting questions. You know, a lot of people have businesses, again, I'm not talking about Israel, I'm not saying in America, they have retail businesses out of their basement or out of their homes, which might often be a violation of zoning rules, number one. But number two, they don't take checks and they don't take credit cards. They only take cash. Right? They say, I'll sell you whatever, I'll sell you cheesecakes for cash. Now, why do they only take cash? Because when you have a business, you got to pay sales tax, and you got to pay income tax. But if it's a cash business, the government doesn't really know they could find out in some ways, but it's much harder. So essentially, when you're paying cash to these cash businesses, you are helping them avoid payment of taxes. So you are assisting them in the commission of a sin. So there are some rabbis who are very strict, who actually say, you are not allowed to patronize a cash-only business, because you become a participant in a violation of the halakhic obligation to follow the law of the land. I'm not giving you a decision on this. I'm just telling you that following the law of the land is an important thing. Now, I will tell you, as I think I mentioned it, that according to Rabbeinu Nissim, according to the Ran, I mentioned the Ran a few days ago, in Eretz Yisrael, law of the land doesn't count, and you only follow the law of the Torah, which is why you will find among some religious people that they say you're allowed to evade tax payments in the state of Israel, because they claim in the state of Israel it is only Torah law that governs. But at the same time, I will tell you that Rebbe Yoshev was the Gadol Hador. He just died 2 years ago. He was over 100 years old. Amazing. He was still answering Shilas and Paskening Shilas well into his 10th decade. And he did Paskin that one must obey the law of the land, even in Eretz Yisrael. One should not take advantage of that. And that's besides a whole other consideration of desecrating God's name. That's a whole other aspect. That if religious Jews don't follow the laws of the land, people will think of them as lawless and disrespectful, and that brings God's name into disrepute. That's besides Dina de Malchus Adina. That is a major issue of Chilul Hashem, which is very, very severe. Yeah?
So like as a United States citizen, so, if you're not living in the United States, but they say you're supposed to follow foreign income, would that be considered breaking the law of the land?
That is an absolutely phenomenal question. That's a great, great question. And that is, okay, I got to obey the law of the land. What if I'm an American citizen and American law applies to me, but I don't live in the United States? Am I still obligated to obey American law when I am not a resident of America? Excellent question. It would seem to me, I didn't see a psak in this actually, that according to the Rebbe, again, I go back to the Ran in Nedarim. The Ran in Nedarim says the following. The Ran in Nedarim says, the logic of Dina de Malchus Adina is that when you are living in a country, your living in the country is an acceptance of the laws of that country, because otherwise they could kick you out. So according to the Ran, it would seem to me that it is very critical where you are actually living. But based on other sources, I would think you would still be chayav. So it would be a machlokas, be a very interesting machlokas. You are correct. There is a duty to report foreign income. In fact, it's very, very strict. If you have a foreign bank account in another country, you have to file special forms reporting it, and the government, this really came because of drug money and laundering, but it is a very, as I know myself, it's a very, very strict reporting requirement.
In terms of the will, let's say that the father halachically decides his will that the double portion goes to the firstborn and then so on and so forth. What if the son decides, it's nice my father gave me the double portion, but I want to split it evenly amongst my siblings?
Yeah, excellent question. But the answer is relatively simple, and that is, once you inherit property, you can do with it whatever you want. So when the Torah says a firstborn gets a double portion, that doesn't mean he has to keep the double portion. He gets the double portion. If he then wants to share it with his sister, with his uncle, with his grandmother, with tzedakah, he is absolutely free. The Torah never says you got to keep something. So there's absolutely no problem with that.
And it doesn't conflict with honoring your mother and father?
No, it does not. Because mom and dad just indicated who gets the property initially. Now if they said in the will, and I want you to keep it, that might be a different question. But if they simply said, you are the one that gets it initially, that's just the inheritance rule. And that doesn't stop you from giving it away. I mean, if your parents gave you a gift, and you wanted to share some of the gift with somebody else, you normally can do that, unless they said specifically, do not share. But just giving you a gift doesn't stop you from sharing it. So an inheritance would be very much the same thing. Yeah?
The person that's working for this cash-only business is also supporting the
policy? It might be. It might be a worker, might not be as bad, because he's not financially contributing, but I think there's a problem. The cash business...
He's kind of inevitably going to come to... He paid taxes also because...
Well, that's right. He might be a tax evader himself because he'll get paid in cash. Yeah, the whole thing is cash, meaning the income is cash and the salaries are in cash.
So should he quit the job or...
Well, I don't want to give you exact because, again, there are heterim, but according to the stricter view, he should not work there. He should not work there. Honesty is a big deal. You know, the Gemara in Shabbos says... Now, people think sometimes, oh, Orthodox Jews are not honest in business, but my answer to that would be a bit of a flippant answer. You know, the same way you can't be an Orthodox Jew that eats pork, because you're not Orthodox, you can't be an Orthodox Jew who doesn't keep Shabbos. I would submit you cannot be an Orthodox Jew that is dishonest in business, because then by definition you're not an Orthodox Jew, even if you keep Shabbos and wear tefillin. And the Gemara in Shabbos tells us that after we die, Hashem is going to ask us 6 questions. This is great. He gives us the final exam ahead of time. And if you have the answer to these questions, you're going to be okay. Only 6 questions. I'll give you all 6, although my point is just for the first question, but I'll mention all 6, so you'll have the exam to study for. Question number 1 is, did you conduct your business affairs with honesty and integrity? That is the first question. The first, were you honest in business? The second question is, did you set aside regular times for the study of Torah? That's question number 2. Question number 3, did you try to have children be fruitful and multiply? Did you at least try procreation? Question number 4, did you eagerly wait for Mashiach? Not did you believe in Mashiach in your head, but were you yearning for Mashiach? That's very important. You know the story about the guy who was planning a vacation. He was going to retire and go to Miami for 2 weeks. And the day he retired, Mashiach came. And he was very angry. He said to God, "You know, God, you kept us waiting 2,000 years. Couldn't you do it after my 2-week vacation? You got to ruin my vacation." Okay, it's funny, but there's a certain truth to it. Do we really, really want Mashiach, or do we just say it? Right? Do we yearn for Mashiach? Okay. Question number 5 is more abstract. Did you occupy your mind with wisdom? Did you use your mind to delve, not just learn Torah, but to delve into the intricate wisdom of Torah? And question number 6, did you seek an intimate relation with God, with Hashem? These are our 6 questions. All of them are very, very important. But the point I'm making about honesty is the very, very first question that Hashem gives us is, were we honest in our business? Now, I want to go back and give you the phrase in Hebrew, because there's a certain double entendre in the Hebrew that is worthy of note. The Hebrew phrase is nasasa v'nasata, meaning business, b'emuna, in faithfulness. So I want to focus on, there are actually 2 translations of emuna. One translation is honesty and integrity. The other translation is, did you conduct your business with faith in God? Emunah. Now, I hope you could see that there's actually a connection in the 2 explanations. Because if you believe that your success in business comes from God, then you can't believe that you're going to be successful by being dishonest. And I know that Rabbi Wasserman, I think, gives you a whole bunch of classes in business ethics. Now, it's true that in the short term, people do get success. I mean, you know, listen, there's Bernie Madoff. I mean, you know, a person can make millions and millions of dollars by lying and cheating in the short term. But in the long term, things are going to fall apart. And therefore, if you believe I could succeed by cheating, then you don't believe in God fully. And that's why the 2 translations of Emunah are connected in that way. Okay. Now, the final point I want to mention about Bechor is a very ingenious vort of the Vilna Gaon, and it's quite amazing. Here is the question the Vilna Gaon was given, an actual question. The question was, a man was married to a woman, he divorced her, but at the time the woman was pregnant. It's unfortunate that a man would divorce a pregnant woman, but he divorced a pregnant woman. He then marries another woman. That other woman gets pregnant. But that other woman has a premature child after 7 months. And then the divorced woman had a full-term pregnancy and gave birth to a child after 9 months. In other words, the child of the divorced woman was conceived first, but born second. Both of them have the same father. Right? Different mothers makes no difference here. So the question that was asked to the Vilna Gaon is, what is the definition of a firstborn who gets a double inheritance? Is it based on first to be conceived? Or is it based on first to be born? Because if it's first to be conceived, then the child of the divorced wife would get the double portion, first to be conceived. But if it's first to be born, then it would be the premature child of the second wife that would get Pishnayim. So is Pishnayim based on Yitzira? Yitzira means conception. Or is it based on Leda, which means birth? Difficult question. So the Vilna Gaon says, oh, I'll give you the answer from the Chumash directly. And here it is. In the part of the Pishnayim, it begins the following. When a man has two wives, one is beloved and one is hated, and they give birth, the Ahuva and the Snua. Now look what it says. Yoldu lo bonim ha'ahuva v'hasnua. The wife that he loves gives birth, and the wife that he hates gives birth. But in the order, which one gave birth first? It says, the wife that he loves gives birth. That's what it says. V'yoldu lo banim, first the ahuva, then the snua, but then the pasuk says that the bechor belongs to the hated wife. The pasuk is contradicting itself. It says, yoldu lo banim, the ahuva gave birth and the snua gave birth, but the bechor belongs to the snua. And the Torah says you must give the double portion to the son of even the hated wife. So what's going on? So the Vilna Gaon says, this is mamish genius, he says, this pasuk is talking about exactly this case. The wife is hated, meaning she was divorced. The beloved wife gave birth first after 7 months. Yoldu lo banim ho'ahuva v'hasnua. But still, the Ben HaBechor belongs to the hated wife because that was the first one that was conceived. So according to the Vilna Gaon, he interprets the pasuk directly to tell me that Pishnayim is based on conception and not on birth. This is recorded in the name of the Vilna Gaon. I will tell you this. The great Rosh Hashiva of Volozhin, the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, writes that he believes that this was a mistake of some disciple who didn't understand the Vilna Gaon. He said, it's impossible for this to be true. The Netziv says, it is a davar pashut miyot, that the definition of a bechor is based on birth, not based on conception. So it's interesting. And the name of the Vilna Gaon, it is recorded, it is based on conception. The Netziv says, it is a mistake. So I can't, I'm not here to tell you who's right in this. Now the Netziv, of course, let me point out the obvious. The Netziv would never in a million years argue with the Vilna Gaon. He does not say, God forbid, the Vilna Gaon is wrong. But he says that whoever recorded this teaching in the name of the Vilna Gaon did not understand it correctly. And the Vilna Gaon could never have said such a thing. Okay, but it's fascinating. Without any mafarshim, the Vilna Gaon looks at the verses themselves and he derives this interesting halacha. Okay, have a good day. We'll see you later. Yeah.
Because he says it's now about the but they were not identical.
Two wives. One is beloved, one is hated. And they gave birth, the beloved and the hated. That implies the beloved gave birth first. The firstborn being the beloved.
Mr. First, because she was the
first. There's another ending question.
Yeah.
And it can happen that me, by according to biology,
yeah,
the seed, it can arrive.
According to the Gra,
Yaakov
could be the real.
But according to Nasi,
Yaakov would not be a real.
That's very interesting.
Yaakov's
nation
is exactly
the same. Can I ask another question? I read the Chumash, maybe. There's a case when a man comes to a woman in the field and she's a Bisula and she was not married, she was not Nisuin. Then when he defied her, then the father, he should give the father 50 shekels. She should take the woman as a wife. He should take
if he wants.
Only if she was. Why?
This is very strange. To modern sensibilities, it's very strange.
Why should
that a rapist would want to marry a rapist?
Right.
Yeah, I understand. And she could say no. She could better say no.
But there was
a concept that unfortunately a woman was damaged goods and maybe nobody would ever want to marry her. So she has a right to say, you must take care of me.
But why should he stay with a rapist? I mean, she like got. I don't think that a rape is very nice thing for a woman, though she got a psychological.
No, you're right.
And then she decided, okay, I want to live with her, but it's only that.
No, you're right. I guess it's most of the time she won't want.
Yeah.
But she has the right to marry. She has the right. It's a right.
It's a right.
She's not. She is, God forbid, she is not forced. So she doesn't want.
How do you learn Rashi's in Humash? Is it like to learn Rashi's in Gomorrah? Like all the things that Rashi's, all those kinds of gender. As long as I learn Rashi's in Humash, and I don't understand why is he explaining this.
Listen, Rashi in Chumash is also in. You need to be mine.
Yeah.
Many commentaries on Rashi.
Right.
You know the Sifsei Chachamim?
Yeah, I know. Look at this. What about Shalom Moira? You know the Shalom
Moira? Yeah, Shalom Moira is good. All of them are good.
Yeah.
Everything Rashi does. Chumash, Gemara, you have to think about a lot.
Okay.
If anything, Rashi in Chumash might even be more complicated. Rashi in Gemara is giving you projects.
Yeah.
Rashi in Chumash gives you many midrashim. And why did Rashi choose this midrash and not this midrash? You know.
When in Talmud Onko there's sometimes different nusach and it's written in Brekts nusach acher. How do you read it? Do you skip it? Do you read it second time? Do you read it with the
Shnayim Mikra?
Yeah.
No, you can skip.
Sometimes I read it with the bread together with the bread.
It's okay, also, you don't have to. The official nusach is without the bread.
Ah,
it's
somebody.
Minority.
Okay. What does it mean in the what question to yearn? Now I get the idea of just not wanting to live your own life. The example you gave, that makes
what
sense.
What it means practically is a good question.
See, here we go.
It means that you feel emotion.
I don't know what that means.
There is something missing in your life. And your soul.
So are you saying, might I understand, that when we look around the world and we see things, we go, it shouldn't be like this. It's like this, but it shouldn't be like this. So a friend and I were talking, and he was like, you know, it's really cool. We're at the Koto for Shabbos. And he said, look at all these minyanim. He's like, it's great. He said, and it's horrible. He said, it's great. And the people can express themselves individually. He said, why aren't we one? Why aren't we one? And so, is it that idea, like, you see it, and say, we should all be together?
I think that's right. Although I'm not sure I would agree with that particularly.
Okay.
But you can be one, and I agree that when there's disunity, it's really very bad. But on the other hand, if everybody loves each other, they want to think you have it. I would think that's like the 12 tribes. You didn't say, let's just have one big tribe.
Right.
This is the notion that each person has a uniqueness.
But yeah, I think there is a concept in that. One of the ways we can look at the, world that way, we can look at the Bible. That's why you're feeling something to you. Yeah. You kind of have to recognize it because we don't have good will. Now you're referring to a senior or a
senior. And junior. I know them all. Mitchell and then Rick senior at the time.
Oh,